This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. In 1983, an educational commission formed under President Ronald Reagan released a 35-page report called A Nation at Risk, The Imperative for Educational Reform. That report laid the groundwork for decades of reforms, many of which remain in place today. In a new book, Dr. Bettina Love lays out how a, quote, 35-page educational report manufactured an educational crisis of catastrophic proportions that destroyed generations of Black families. A crisis that joined the educational industry with the prison industry. To remedy the harm, Dr. Love calls for an implementation of what she calls educational reparations. Dr. Bettina Love is the William F. Russell Professor at Teachers College, Columbia University, and the best-selling author of We Want to Do More Than Survive. She is also co-founder of the Abolitionist Teaching Network and a founding member of the task force that launched the program In Her Hands, one of the largest guaranteed income pilot programs in the U.S. She joins me to discuss her new book, Punished for Dreaming, How School Reform Harms Black Children and How We Heal. Welcome to the program, Dr. Love.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let's start with Reagan, as I mentioned in my introduction. And you write about how this report had a nation at risk, had a huge impact on the state of the U.S. education system. So tell me about this report and how it set the stage for harm, particularly on Black children.
Yes. Well, thank you for that question. You know, I think it's important for your listeners to know that Brown versus the Board of Education was really the spark that got what we would call the far right organized. And so in the late 1970s, the right, the Republican Party, is already telegraphing that they have a problem with public education, that they don't want to fund public education, that they don't see the need for public education. And they believe that public education is taking resources from the children that they believe have the most potential. So that's already happening. And that's really the backlash from Brown versus the Board of Education. So that those ideas are forming in the late 1970s. When Reagan takes office, there is a report, some findings around public education being disastrous and that test scores are down. And then when Reagan takes office by 1983, that report that's laying those ideas around public education go right into this report, A Nation at Risk. And so A Nation at Risk was already going to be written no matter what the data said. Now, in 1983, A Nation at Risk, like you said, a 35-page report lays out the idea that public education in this country is failing so badly to other Western countries that it may cause war, right? We see the fear-mongering. And what we see is that they begin to create and manufacture a crisis. Because there's a lot of data at that time that says that education is doing okay. There's also other data that says education is doing really well. They don't use any of that data. And so what you see is the education report, one of the most consequential education reports pretty much of the last 60 years, that starts to tell the public that public education is failing with little data, misleading data, and many myths around public education. And the report doesn't say anything about race. It doesn't say Black children or these children. But what we see is that after the report, the Heritage Foundation and other groups start to signal and talk about race. And so the report is a linchpin to how we talk about Black children in this country. And it starts these reforms aimed at Black children, poor children, working class children, and children of color.
I love how you bring up this term super predators and turn it around on its head. Let's talk about, first of all, where that term super predators came from and how it was used to describe Black youth and how you identify the real super predators and who they are.
Yes, and so you see the phrase super predator pop up in the 80s and 90s. And it was started to use around how do we have some type of crime reform in this country. And so we start to see Black youth be called crack babies and thugs, and then they become super predators. And the most famous line is 1996, Hillary Clinton calling children super predators. But before Hillary Clinton, it's almost popularized in the media, law enforcement, politicians, first ladies, everyone calling Black children super predators. And we see it really with the Central Park Five, right? When we see these young Black boys who are created as monsters in the media, that they are vicious and they are super predators. And so that term begins to be used to say that a group of children, mind you, are lawless, have no remorse, and that these are the individuals that we need to penalize, punish, and incarcerate, full stop. And so when I think about the term super predators, I wanted to use it in the book in a way that really gets at who is actually the super predator. Because I'm the generation that was called the super predators, right? I'm an 80s baby. I was born in 1979. So I grew up with these terms and the ways in which we were talked about, my generation. But I wanted to say that the real super predators are the individuals who call children super predators, first of all. Second of all, the individuals who profit off of Black children's demise, individuals who create policies and reforms, who they know are going to fail with little experience, no expertise, and no real concern about how they talk about and create policies that will dictate Black people's lives. And then they turn around and profit from that. They actually are the ones who are the super predators. Because Black folks in this country have always believed in education. We've always fought for education. Newly freed slaves, the first thing they did was build schools and churches. And so we have always believed as Black people and people of color in the American dream, in the idea of education being the great equalizer. And I argue in the book that folks have taken deep advantage of that and used it against us to create charter schools and vouchers and all these type of programs that they know doesn't have success, unproven success, but they still use it. We run to it looking for what we need for our children and they profit off of it. So I say in the book that they are the ones who are the real super predators, not the actual children that they call super predators in the 80s and 90s.
And then picking up on that, how did Reagan's ideas marry with the economic ideas of Milton Friedman? And I love that you make that connection in the book, because the sense of government needs to get out of everything, the free market will take care of everything, especially has been applied to Black children, disproportionately so than white children, right?
Right. So Milton Friedman, we don't talk enough about Milton Friedman. And really, we think about him as an economist, which he is. But he also was what we would call the godfather, the father of school choice in this country. So after Brown versus the Board of Education, Milton Friedman starts to write around school choice. It's not a coincidence that right after Brown versus the Board of Education, Milton Friedman starts to write around schooling and school choice. And one of Milton Friedman's most famous lines is that if a owner of a restaurant doesn't want to hire Black people, that owner isn't racist. It's the taste of the restaurant patrons. And so it's a taste issue. Let the free market play it out. So it's all about the free market. And so you see him come up with very clever ways to hide systematic racism, to disguise systematic racism, and to say, it's just a free market. Let the free market take care of it all. And so he begins to apply those ideas of the free market that should take care of it all, and it's just taste, to education. And he becomes what we would call, right, the godfather of choice, school choice, because, hey, here are the choices, and let people decide what they want. But now Milton Friedman is not going to address racism, the violence of school segregation, the inequalities to the system. He's not going to address all of that. He's going to say it's a choice. And so what I argue in the book is that, yes, we do have school choice, but school choice are the choices once white folks have divvied up they want and then leave the rest for us and call it school choice. And so Milton Friedman's ideas begin to permeate all throughout American, the American ethos, from Reagan to top executives throughout the world. He's seen as a hero for his ideas around the government should do nothing. The government should never intervene. It's all about the markets. And that means that Negroes and Black folks at the time, you got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You got to do it on your own, right? Because the free market, it will determine what happens. And so he begins to give language to this idea that, you know, everything, the free market will handle it all. And those who don't succeed, well, they didn't work hard enough. Those who didn't succeed, they're not competitive enough. So we need competition.
So if you fail, it's the fault of the child. If a child is getting a failing grade, it's the fault of the child, not the fault of the system for failing to educate the child.
That's let the free market decide. Yep, exactly.
So let's talk about the state of American education today. We've had so many school reforms ushered in by various presidents, right? I mean, there was famously George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind. Even President Obama signed the Every Child Succeeds Act. Have these subsequent reforms that came after Reagan essentially served to entrench the same ideology of get the government out, create these hyper-competitive environments, and then if you fail, we've done our best, and it just means that you're not good enough? Has it been one thing after another along the same lines?
Yeah, you know, the one thing I argue in the book is that if you look at what, you know, let's be very clear, what the Republican Party in education is doing right now, this right here, we haven't seen this since Brown versus the Board of Education. But for the last 40 years, up until right now, the Republicans and the Democrats have been locked in step in educational policy. They pretty much mirrored each other. So when it comes to being punitive, charter schools, vouchers, we haven't seen the type of funding we would need for education and teachers. And so they've pretty much been locked in step with all of these big time initiatives that they would like to champion as education reforms, but these reforms don't address inequality in any real way. What they do is actually further charter schools. They further inequality, never addressing any of the real issues. We have 1 in 5 teachers in this country who moonlight. Teachers have not, the teaching profession salaries have not kept pace at all with other professions. And if we look at how Black teachers, you know, Black male teachers make up 2%, less than 2% of the teaching population. Black women teachers make up less than 6 to 8% of the teaching population. So we haven't done anything to really address the teacher shortage. And now here we are on the precipice of a huge teacher shortage in this country that we knew was coming. Each president. So if you look at what has happened over the last 40 years, now the Republican Party today, they're not only advancing charter schools and school choice and virtual schools and trying to undercut, you know, public education. They're also advancing the ideas of anti-Blackness and racism within schools, homophobia, transphobia within schools. So yes, they have broken away, but for the last 40 years, the Democrats and Republicans have been lockstep in the ideas of what can reform education, and they've been pretty much the same.
But let's get to this idea of educational reparations and how we fix the harms of reforms. I won't use the word reform. How we fix the harms of reform, how we repair, if you will, the harms of reform. And I'm wondering if you can start with your own story, which you tell in your book, how you grew up in a school that saw you a particular way. And also your own peers. You, in fact, tell the story of a friend who you called Zook in your book. If you can link that personal to then the reparative vision that you would like to see for schools, I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I thought it was really important to put myself and my friends and other people in this book, because I think oftentimes when we talk about reform, we don't talk about there's real people. Like, reform has a real impact on people's lives. And so I start the book with me. You know, I'm from Rochester, New York, born and raised, and I went to a huge high school, which was about, you know, 1500 kids. My freshman class was 700 kids, and we graduated maybe 180 kids. So we had a 25% graduation rate. And I had my best friend there. Her name was Zukiya, and she was everything to me. You know, I was a freshman. She was a senior. She could dribble the ball. She could score. She had the best sneakers. She was funny. I wanted to be Zuk. And I was on the basketball team. And the middle of the season, maybe late in the season, there's a cheating scandal at my school. And allegedly, Zuk and some other male athletes are not going to class. And so at the end of the season, we get all our games taken away. We were like 22-1. We ended up being 1-22. And at Zook's disciplinary hearing, they start telling her all the things she didn't do. She's in there by herself and she hits a teacher. And from that, I learned that that punch that Zook threw that day was not just to that teacher. It was a school system where she never had any teachers tell her that she was smart. She never had any teachers, any mentors in education. When she was in elementary school, she had a teacher who put her in the chokehold and threw her to the ground. She was also facing so much in her community with the loss of her mother, and nobody ever cared. Nobody ever stopped. And that's what school reform did. When we lost relationships, when we came testing, when we lost Black teachers, when we lost the sense that children were coming to school, not products, not a business model, but children were coming to school. And that some of the children coming to school are there in trauma and they need our help. They need our support. And all we have for them is punishment. And so I saw how one of my closest, dearest friends as an 17-year-old kid was thrown out of school, was punished and thrown away. And it really got me thinking as a 14-year-old kid, oh my God, they'll throw you away. It doesn't make a difference how funny you are, how many points you can score, how well you can dribble a basketball. You make one mistake as a Black kid, they'll throw you away. And it was really the change, and it stayed with me. And I think that was why I started the book with Zukiya's story, because it really helped me understand as a very young person how punishment and education work together.
And so then what can be done to repair this harm? Talk about what educational reparations are. You have some other ideas in your book that people have been talking about. But this basic idea that because you have a demographic in this country that has systematically been oppressed and that never has had compensation, that we need to talk about reparations. There's a discussion of reparations in general, you know, the kind that the state of California is considering. But then there's what you say is educational reparations. What are those?
So, yeah, you know, when you think about reparations in this country, particularly for Black folks, right, we think about you getting pulled over by the cops, racial profiling, mass incarceration, which Erica Minor calls targeted mass incarceration. We think about not getting a home loan because you're Black, not getting a business loan because you're Black, having your business or your home devalued because you are Black. Like, these are what we will see as the levers for reparation, which have contributed to what we would call the wealth gap. So there's a huge wealth gap in this country because Black folks have not been able to take part in wealth in this country. But I would argue, when I argue in the book, is that I believe all those things are correct. But before I'm denied a home loan, before I'm denied a business loan, before my business is devalued, I'm Black in this country and I'm educated in America's schools. And I am being harmed every single day by the way that America's schools are set up to do harm to Black children. And we call it reform, we call it gaps, but it's harm. And the best example I can give your listeners are a few things. Number one, the way we fund schools in this country is inherently unequal. Like, we fund schools by property taxes, meaning that those who have the wealthiest properties will have the wealthiest schools. You cannot talk about equity and justice when you systematically ensure my demise through the way in which you fund schools. So there was a great report that came out in 2016 by Ed Builder. And Ed Builder said, non-white schools receive $23 billion less in funding than white schools. I'll say that one more time. Non-white schools in 2016 received $23 billion, with a B, less funding than white schools. That's like, what is, like, you can't sit here and talk about achievement gap and race to the top and all of these educational initiatives when I'm $23 billion in the hole, right? So we also know that students who need the most, students who are behind in reading, students who are behind in math, who need the most, get the least inexperienced teachers in our system, right? So I need the most and I get a teacher who's the least experienced. I need a veteran teacher, but that's the way the system is set up. We also have students who need the most with 35 other students in the classroom. You, as a teacher, you honestly cannot do your job effectively and well when you are one teacher with 30 kids in the classroom. So we know there's things that work and things that we need, but we are systematically choosing not to do it. And so I'm being educated in a system that is choosing not to educate me properly and effectively. And you are going to impact the rest of my learning and earning potential for the rest of my life, what I will earn for the rest of my life. So what we know right now is that if you do not graduate high school and you do graduate high school, there's about $250,000 difference. And so what I argue in the book is that those individuals who do not graduate
high school. And when you say $250,000 difference, you mean like an earning potential over the course of a lifetime?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, over the course of your lifetime. This is a $250,000 difference. So what we know is that I'm now being impacted. And I don't believe that children are dropping out of school. They're pushed out of school through reform policies, through policing, through testing, through bouncing from school to school. These are the ways in which we have to start to frame education. So we hear all of these statistics and we see them as data points. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, that's sad. We have to see them as a issue to take up through reparations. And through the data that a team of researchers that I work with who are absolutely amazing, we looked at just my generation and we were up to $2 trillion. And that's a conservative estimate, right? One thing I learned about working with economists, you got to be conservative. So $2 trillion just for the last 40 years of educational harm, my generation.
So then educational reforms, looking at how, or rather reparations, looking at how schools are funded, if schools where kids of color are predominant are getting funded so much dramatically less, short of tax reform, changing how we fund schools based on taxes, the federal government could simply make up the shortfall by infusing cash into the schools that serve poor kids of color, right? That's one basic thing, and that would go toward reducing class size, improving teacher retention, etc.
They did that in the pandemic, right? Mm. Like, we got to be clear, the pandemic showed us was a portal of what was possible. We had the lowest levels of poverty that we've had in almost a century in the pandemic. So it's possible. They could do it tomorrow if they wanted to.
That's such a great point. It basically offered this experiment in the government choosing to actually do what a government is supposed to do, as opposed to take the Reagan approach of completely pulling out and leaving people to fend for themselves.
The one thing I want everybody to know, and I'm not the first to say this, this is not groundbreaking, but we can't underscore this. Poverty, the funding, the defunding of education, many of the issues that we have are policy issues. Poverty is a policy issue. The underfunding and the current state of education, that is a policy issue. And so with actual policies that can impact and a positive impact, we can make change in our country. And so we have to be helping people to understand that these are policy issues. And if we don't see it as policy, just, oh, people got to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. People, oh, just got to work harder. You know, you got people in this country right now working every single day that don't make enough money to put a roof over their head. That's a policy issue. You have people going to school. You have kids going to school every day right now without drinking water in this country. You have schools right now in this country, the United States of America, that don't have drinking water, don't have clean air. They have so many pollutants in the AC vents and the HVACs, and all of the stuff we use to kill mice and rodents and bugs that is polluting the air. Teachers in Oakland went on strike last year, not just for pay. They wanted better working conditions because, as Erica Miner tells us, teachers' working conditions are students' learning conditions.
Right.
And so when you're in a school right now but doesn't have clean water, doesn't have clean air, and you're talking to me about, and teachers are moonlighting and can't make a living wage, that's a policy issue. And you got the audacity to tell me to pull myself up by my bootstraps? Come on.
Finally, Dr. Bettina Love, given that the demographics of this nation are changing, we are a more diverse than ever nation, racially speaking, and white people will lose their majority status shortly, you know, in just a few years and decades. Are you hopeful that that changing demographics will usher in the kind of repair that you are hopeful for simply by virtue of the fact that there are more of us fighting for these things?
Yes and no. Like we got to be clear. As Zora Neale Hurston says, all your skin folk ain't your kin folk. So yes, I am always hopeful. I stay hopeful because I believe in Black women. I believe in queer folks. I believe in people of color. I believe in us. So I'm always hopeful. But we have to be able to have solidarity as people of color. We have to be able to understand each other's history and plights and the ways we've resisted, the ways each community has loved, and where there's solidarity. Because if we don't have that solidarity, having a lot of Black and brown folks, that's great. But just because we're here, representation does not mean power. And so we got to do a lot of educating. We got to do a lot of community work. We got to understand where each other is coming from. We got to talk more. And so I'm optimistic, but I'm also fearful because now we're living in a country where we are as divided and we don't communicate. We don't talk. We don't break bread with each other. So how will I know where the solidarity is? How will I know what you're going through? How will I have empathy for you? And so I'm hopeful, but I'm also intentional that we keep building as Black and brown people and Indigenous people in solidarity. We keep learning about each other, learning from each other. So when it comes time to vote, I understand why I need to vote this way. And it may not impact me at all, but I know that my, you know, Asian brother, sister, they needs this vote, right? So we gotta talk more. We gotta understand each other more and see where folks are coming from.
I love that. And it's a wonderful note to end on. Dr. Bettina Love, thank you so much and good luck with your book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Bettina Love. She's the William F. Russell Professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. And we've been discussing her latest book, Punished for Dreaming, How School Reform Harms Black Children and How We Heal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.